This is an ABC podcast.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Good afternoon, Nikolai Bailhart's with you for The Country Hour this Tuesday lunchtime. On the program today, you might like doing a bit of recreational fishing. One of the big selling points, of course, is the calm, the peace and quiet you can get while you're doing it. But when you're a commercial fisherman, that can also lead to a fair bit of isolation. So how can fishermen try and keep up their spirits and mental health? We'll take a look at that today. Also on the program, halloumi may be next in the EU's targets for geographic protection. That means only people from Cyprus could use the term halloumi. What does that mean for those who make the cheese here? We'll find out shortly. To start today, though, the cooler summer weather has hit the yield of this season's lucerne seed crop, which could drop by as much as 20%. The irrigated lucerne seed harvest is coming to an end in the upper southeast. Keith-based agronomist Scott Hutchings says he's expecting total yields to be below average.
This has mainly been because of seasonal conditions. We've had a lot of kind of cool, windy weather with rainfall at various times during the season with showers. So, yeah, we're seeing basically a crop that's kind of slightly below long-term averages on the back of two record years previous to that.
What percentage below is it?
I'd say probably 10 to 20% below long-term averages.
Yields may be down, but what is the quality of that seed like?
The early part of the harvest, the quality was quite good, even though yields were slightly down. So what we basically saw during, as yields sort of moderately down at the start of harvest, so earlier crops generally yielded slightly higher, and as the seasons progressed, the effect of weather and seed wasp has taken a larger effect on those crops, and also large aphid infestations has reduced the yields and reduced the quality as the season progressed. So the earlier shut-up crops seem to perform a little bit more consistently, although it's fair to say that across the spectrum, crops were inconsistent. We'd often have properties where there was two or three good crops and then a poorer crop. And that can be related to flowering time or a particular variety or the time of the phase in which it was irrigated.
You mentioned a few pests earlier there. Have they been a bit more prevalent this season, especially later in the season, because of that cooler weather?
Yeah, we tend to find in cooler seasons that mirids and aphids and seed wasps tend to be more of an issue, whereas in hotter, drier seasons, you tend to see more budworm, native budworm. So this year we kind of saw towards the end of the season seed wasps become a little bit of a problem. And historically that has no registered chemical control. And yeah, we also saw a breakdown in the basically some aphids that became resistant to some of the organophosphate chemicals we use, which has been a problem for a number of years, but probably in a larger extent this year.
How is it comparing to the dry seed harvest, which occurred a little bit earlier?
Yeah, well, the dryland harvest in total area was down, like has been down for about 3 years, and that's been like in total volume and area shut up for seed. And that's been mainly because of higher livestock prices and dry conditions in spring. There hasn't been enough subsoil moisture to lock that lucerne seed up. But what was shut up generally performed well, relatively well. Once again, there's always quite a bit of variability in dry land harvest. But the crops that were shut up were generally the pick of the paddocks, and they performed relatively well. And, you know, we had paddocks going up to 300 to 400 kilos.
That's Cox Rural agronomist Scott Hutchings speaking there with Bridget Herman. 9 past 12 here on The Country Hour. My name's Nikolai Bailharts. Well, the national program focusing on mental health in the fishing industry has teamed up with an Eyre Peninsula mental health group to try and continue to help those in the industry. Seafood Industry Australia's Stay Afloat program runs mental health workshops and will be working with Mentally Fit EP to run 2 mental health first aid courses in May. Stay Afloat program manager Joe Marshall says the program so far helped to try and break down some of the stigma around mental health in the industry. She told Brooke Neindorf she's hoping this new partnership will help that even more.
Look, we're really excited, Brooke, to be working with Mentally Fit EP. Our commitment to this program is to be rolling out activities that improve the overall and mental health and wellness of members of our seafood community. Mentally Fit EP are on the ground locally. They know many people from within our industry and are really proactive in helping us establish our mental health first aid training and also contributing towards some of the community activities that we're planning for the region.
Tell us about this mental health first aid training that will be run.
Sure. So mental health first aid training is an accredited program from Mental Health First Aid Australia. We were able to bring this program to quite a number of seafood communities around the nation. Port Lincoln and Streaky Bay will be amongst the first to roll out this two-day course that really provides community members with the skills to understand and see the signs of mental health problems and also really helps them build the skills of how to have the conversations with people that might be suffering from mental health problems or even in crisis.
And with these people that can do this course, is it you said the word community there, so it's not just those who might directly work in the fishing industry, but those around them. We obviously see Port Lincoln is a big fishing community, Streaky Bay also. Yeah. People that might be just outside of the industry can take part as well?
Yeah, we're really encouraging family members yes, fishers, but members of all parts of the sector and their family members. And there's bound to be others that are connected to the sector and hear about the challenges faced and can upskill themselves to enable them to have meaningful conversations with those people.
How has the Stay Afloat program helped so far since it started?
Look, so far what we've been doing is really trying to raise awareness of the program. And what we're seeing is a lot of people coming back to us saying, we think this is fantastic. In some areas of Australia, we've actually had people come back and say, look, I've sought help as a result of conversations with people involved with this program, and that has enabled me to change my life to a point where I'm no longer suffering the challenges or the risks that I had. A lot of people really just starting to talk about the topic at this stage, starting to feel more comfortable with talking about the topic and sharing their own stories.
Have you been surprised by how many people have taken it on and what they've been able to take from it?
Yeah, look, what I've been surprised about is the willingness of our fishers and others in industry to engage in conversation. So, you know, in some cases, as I said, it's that quite direct and deep level of sharing that they actually, you know, suffer from mental health problems from time to time. And others simply saying, you know, I'm happier to talk about stress and I'm happier to talk about the challenges. And equally starting to focus on some of the positive aspects around prevention and early intervention. So whilst we're talking about mental illness, mental health problems and preventing it, there's a lot of conversations going on about how do we bring positivity into our workplace? How do we remember the fantastic things about being at sea and being part of this industry? And so there's a lot of conversations going on around that as well, which is really exciting. It's as you say, it's a broader conversation and people are more willing than I imagined they'd be at the beginning of this.
Following the last 12 months, Joe, we saw an increase of stress for the industry. It is quite a stressful industry anyway, on top of all the things that came along with COVID. Have you seen the program help those that have felt that stress over the last 12 months added on from their COVID situation?
Yes, look, we have some live examples, and these things are fairly private for some people, and so we have access to the feedback that we receive from individuals. So we have a number of examples where people have come to us and said, you know, I was really suffering and I am now in a much better place. We know that those stressors are there. We know that they're talking to one another about those things. So we're certainly seeing the signs of shift. We're halfway through the program, and one of the things that we're really excited about is now in areas like Port Lincoln and Streaky Bay, getting more activity happening on the ground to supplement some of the storytelling and some of the initial activities of the program. So between the mental health first aid training, and we're also hoping that there'll be a range of community-based events in the local area over the next few months, I think we'll really see that ramp up even further.
We've seen farmers on land, that stigma really broken down about mental health, and particularly the last couple of years, farmers are not as afraid to talk about it. Do you think that stigma is being broken down in the fishing industry as well?
I don't think it's completely broken down yet. I think these things do take time. I think that people are more willing to talk about the topic and engaging in the positive aspects of it. I think we're still on the journey, though, to really breaking down that stigma completely. I think that will take time.
That is Stay Afloat Program Manager Jo Marshall speaking there with Brooke Neindorf. Yeah, more information at stayafloat.com.au. And if you or anyone you know does need some help or to have a chat to somebody, you can, of course, call Lifeline on 13 11 14.
You're listening to Nikolai Bailharts on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
It is 12:15. Well, farmers in the state's mid-north will soon be seeding with native plants, wheat and canola, in an attempt to regenerate degraded soils. The Regenerating Goyder's Line project involves trialling ways to use different plants to regenerate soils at two sites at Corn and one at Mount Bryan. Upper North Farming Systems Denny Agnew says it's clear that leaving paddocks alone and just hoping they recover isn't working.
We know that just resting these paddocks is not working. So we have three paddocks that are under this trial, two in Corn and one in Mount Bryan, and they have all been rested for over 5 years. So between 10 and 20 years, these paddocks have been rested. So if rest was all it took, then these paddocks would already be re-established as productive ecosystems, and they're not. So this trial is about trying to demonstrate different interventions that may produce some benefits. After that, we hope that we'll be able to have some information to distribute to be able to identify what in fact may be a good intervention for landholders to undertake on their own properties.
And you had a workshop recently on this project about the seeding. Can you tell me what was, I suppose, the thrust of that workshop and what was the interest like from the farmers you attended?
It was a very strong interest from the farmers who have attended. One of the main things we're trying to get out of this workshop is a way forward for landholders who have land that has been out of cropping production for over 10 years and have had land that is now not productive for livestock. And what we're trying to help them to do is to improve their understanding of the Native Vegetation Act, which really is one of the key focuses of the project. A lot of the landholders on the day, on our field day yesterday, really enjoyed getting out into the field, doing some identification of some of the plants that are common throughout the area, finding out sort of from our experts being Anne Brown from Greening Australia and Ben McCullum from the South Australian Arid Lands Landscape Board to sort of find out their palatability, what sort of conditions they like to grow in, what type of soil they like, when is best to keep stock off of those areas to encourage regeneration. So that was really an interesting point.
How important is research like this in, knowing how this sort of country will adapt to climate change?
Well, I think this is really important for working out how our country can adapt in climate change. These areas that are subject to our project, and there are many, many of these areas throughout the district that were once cropped, they were suitable for cropping, and now they are no longer suitable for those activities. So what this research is really valuable is identifying alternative uses for that land. And it's really important that we undertake this work in areas that is subject to these weather conditions. Upper North Farming Systems really was formed about 20 years ago out of a response to drought, and it was about farmers coming together to share experience and to develop research around what is applicable in our patch. So it's really important that we undertake this research in low rainfall areas, as it can potentially in the future set examples for other areas that will experience lower rainfall in coming years due to climate change.
That is Upper North Farming Systems' Denny Agnew speaking there with Lucas Forbes, Nikolai Bailharts with you for the Country Hour on ABC Local Radio. Well, research into finding an economic and environmental solution to a pretty major issue in the meat processing sector has now received more than $500,000 in federal government funding. Southern Cross University is working with a number of other partners, including the Casino Food Co-op, which is Australia's largest meat processing cooperative, on a project looking at transforming meat residues from abattoirs into an agricultural soil improver. Associate Professor Dirk Erler told Kim Honan that they want to turn the waste product, which costs the industry an estimated $75 million in disposals every year, into something that could improve productivity when it comes to grazing and pasture land.
The meat processing sector and food processing in general produces organic wastes, and they have to be disposed of. And currently, most of that waste goes to landfill, but that's not only costly, but it's also a waste of resource. So what we're trying to do is take those organic wastes from meat processing and other food processors and try and turn it into what we're calling smart fertilizers. So these are products that we can put on soil that help to retain nutrients like carbon and nitrogen and phosphorus, but also importantly reduce greenhouse gas emissions from agricultural land.
And do you know how many tons of meat residue the meat co-op generates each year?
So a typical medium-sized facility generates about 4,000 tonnes per annum of these organic residues. The residues would be things like hair sludge that comes from the tannery, paunch, which is gut contents, but also the treatment systems that are already at the meatworks. They produce a sludge as well, which has to be disposed of. So these are quite advanced treatment systems on site, but they all produce some sort of residue. So we're sort of broadly categorising all these things as organic residues. It's really the leftovers from the processing.
So you're looking at developing this new technology to transfer these residues into these smart fertilisers. How will you actually do that?
Yeah, that's right. So we're trying to convert these organic residues into products that can assist with our soil processing. Currently, some of these wastes are composted and then just applied to land, or they're turned into biochar, which is basically a pyrolysis process where the organics are turned into a kind of a charcoal. The problem with compost is that it actually stimulates soil processing and it can generate more greenhouse gas emissions than without the compost itself. Even though it does provide some nutrients to the soil, it kind of supercharges the bacterial processes. With the pyrolysis, the problem with that is that it needs a dry waste to start with. So you spend a lot of energy actually drying the waste before you can perform the pyrolysis itself. Our process is it's called a hydrothermal process, and what we actually do is we heat the organics under pressure. So it's really just like pressure cooking, this stuff, but we add a range of catalysts like minerals and iron oxides, and we can engineer the product to perform a certain function within the soil. So whether it is we want to stimulate a certain bacterial process or we want to retain nutrients and carbon, etc. So the project is really about producing different types of these amendment products and seeing how they work in the soil itself.
And so ideally, would processors have a plant on site to do this?
Yeah, exactly. So that's the idea. Eventually, that this could be done on site by processors. We're going for simple technologies. We're not really looking at the high end type technologies. It's simple technologies that could be done on site. These products can then be distributed to the farmer groups who belong to these co-ops. So it's really trying to create this sort of circular economy within the region.
And how long do you think it will take you to achieve this?
We've already started working on this with a previously funded project that worked with Casino Council and Norco and Richmond Dairies. And now the Casino Abattoirs come on board on this particular project. But we've been working on this hydrothermal technology for a number of years now. We know that it reduces greenhouse gas production, but what's unclear is how it's going to affect other soil microbial processes. So we really need to understand how it may stimulate certain processes or be detrimental to other types of processes. So as I was saying before, you know, putting compost on soil seems like a good idea, but it can actually have a negative impact on greenhouse gas emissions. So we want to make sure that what we're producing is actually has a net benefit to the soil.
That is Associate Professor Dirk Erler from Southern Cross University in Lismore in northern New South Wales, speaking there with Kim Honan.
ABC iView is proud to premiere the gripping new Australian drama, Wakefield. Nick, the psychiatric nurse, is exceptionally good at his job. He has a gift for soothing the afflicted. He can reach the unreachable. But now, his grip on his own sanity is slipping away. And slowly but surely, the mysterious reasons why also unravel.
I've got a bad feeling.
Wakefield. Binge the whole series on ABC iView.
You're listening to Nikolai Bailharts on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
It is 25 past 12. That is, does mean it's time to head off to the Bureau of Meteorology. Senior forecaster on duty is Brett Gage. Afternoon, Brett.
Good afternoon, Nikolai.
Unless I'm misreading things, the relatively warm and calm times continue.
Yes, they will for a few more days at least. Currently, we've got a high of 1,026 hectopascals centred over the Tasman Sea, and that's extending a ridge of high pressure back over our state. And that ridge will be maintained for a couple of days until a trough of low pressure moves across the south of the state late Thursday, and then it will move into the south of the pastoral districts Friday and then through the northeast corner of the state on Saturday. So temperatures are going to climb ahead of that trough, with the hottest day expected to be on Thursday. We should get into the low 30s in the south of the state and the mid-30s in the north. But then behind that change, becoming a bit milder in the south on Friday, remaining hot in the north. And then on Saturday, a cooler, fresh and gusty southerly wind should extend right throughout the state during Saturday. It will still be hot in the far northeast at first, but those cooler winds will get right through the state by Saturday evening. So under the ridge of high pressure, we'll see some early fog patches in the southern agricultural area tomorrow morning, and then in the southeast districts on Thursday morning. And a middle-level cloud band will extend over Kangaroo Island, the southeast districts on Thursday, bringing a slight to medium chance of showers there. And then that cloud band will pass away. But in an onshore airstream on Friday, a slight chance of showers about southern coasts and ranges and the far west coast. And then in that cooler, fresh southerly surge on Saturday, we'll see a slight chance of showers extend over most of the agricultural area and the western coast, increasing to a medium to high chance of showers about southern coasts. So all up, cumulative rainfall totals are from now until midnight Saturday, generally less than 2 millimetres, but possibly reaching 2 to 5 millimetres about the far south of the lower southeast district. Our longer-term outlook from Sunday through to Tuesday, it's just for a slight chance of morning showers about central and eastern coasts on Sunday. We'll see a dry day on Monday. And then we've got a slight chance of showers developing across the west and the south of the state on Tuesday. And it'll be on the cool side Tuesday, but warming up into Tuesday as winds go more northerly.
And so, Brett, as that change makes its way across on Saturday, you mentioned temperatures will drop. How much are we likely to see temperatures dropping down?
So, for example, in Adelaide, we're looking at a maximum of about 31 on Thursday, but a maximum of only 21 for Saturday and Sunday.
And then do things start, so things start to warm up a little bit? I know we're getting towards the end of the forecast, but things warming up a little bit after that?
Yeah, that's right. Winds will go easterly on Monday and then back around to the north on Tuesday. So we'll be looking at temperatures back up into the mid-20s in the south of the state on Tuesday.
Okay, thanks so much, Brett.
You're welcome.
Brett Gage, Senior Forecaster on duty at the Bureau of Meteorology. For the Western Inland Forecast, Upper Western, a sunny day, the chance of a thunderstorm in the northeast in the late afternoon and evening. Winds east to southeasterly, 15 to 20 kilometres, tending south to southeasterly in the middle of the day. Overnight temperatures will fall to around 17, daytime temperatures reaching the low 30s. For Lower Western, it'll be sunny day, winds southeast to southwesterly, 15 to 20 kilometres, becoming light in the afternoon. Overnight temperatures will be falling to between 11 and 16, with daytime temperatures reaching around 30. It's just coming up to half past 12.
listening to The Country Hour. For more stories from across the country, go to abc.net.au/rural. On ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill, this is Nikolai Bailharts.
Hello there, and thanks for your company this afternoon. I thought we could play a little bit of a guessing game this lunchtime. What do you think I'm talking about? A semi-hard cheese that has a high melting point so you can fry it. Sometimes it's a little bit squeaky when you eat it, and it's pretty good with lemon. Now, you might have guessed I'm talking about halloumi, right? But what if we could no longer call it halloumi? Well, that may be the case, as the EU wants to restrict who can use it. So the challenge for you this lunchtime is, if it comes to that fruition, and that is just an if at the moment, what else could we call it if we can't call it halloumi? It's a little bit like the whole champagne versus sparkling debate. Maybe squeaky cheese isn't the worst name. You can send us a text. 0467 922 891 is the text number. 0467 922 891. And it is a serious issue. It has some dairy producers pretty worried, so we'll find out what they're planning to do about it too. First, though, we need to find out what's making news with Wendy Glamacek. Afternoon, Wendy.
The lawyer for a refugee who spent 5 years in detention centres has told the Supreme Court in Adelaide his client was detained in inhospitable, overcrowded centres which were effectively run like prison systems. 46-year-old Payam Sadath is suing the federal government for psychiatric injuries he alleges he suffered during 5 years at the Curtin and Baxter detention centres. The trial is seen as a lead case for about 60 other former detainees who have similar ongoing claims against the Commonwealth. The acting chief medical officer of Australia says the risk of dying from COVID-19 is much higher than the risk of developing blood clots. Australia's vaccine expert advisory group meets again tomorrow to discuss concerns about the AstraZeneca vaccine after a Melbourne man was hospitalised with clots days after getting the jab. And former Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull says the New South Wales government has caved into a ferocious media campaign after his appointment to a Clean Energy Board was overturned. He says there's been a vendetta against him by News Corp since his appointment. More ABC News at 1 o'clock.
Thanks so much, Wendy. In a few moments, so we will be talking mohair madness. Angora goat fibre prices are through the roof at the moment. We'll find out what's driving them so high. As I mentioned a few moments ago, though, there is a question now about whether the days of Australian halloumi are now numbered. It is what dairy industry leaders are concerned about. They say European Union leaders have once again voted to restrict cheese manufacturers from outside Cyprus being able to use the phrase halloumi. It is an issue that's got Australian Dairy Industry Council Chair Terry Richardson pretty worried.
Halloumi is a cheese that can be and is produced anywhere in the world, and the EU is trying to claim that there's something unique about halloumi that is associated with Cyprus, and therefore cheesemakers outside of Cyprus should be prevented from using that name.
And this is essentially a new claim or separate to the ones we've heard about before under the free trade agreement, is that right?
Yes, that's right. So the EU's already made a list of, we consider them unreasonable demands to stop Australian cheese manufacturers using common cheese names such as feta and parmesan and now halloumi.
Yeah, so you mentioned feta and parmesan there. What's the latest in that situation? Are we any closer to a resolution on whether or not we can continue to use those names?
Well, they will all be part of the negotiations underway at the moment between the EU and Australia. So we will be endeavouring to ensure that the Australian government takes account of the Australian dairy industry's concerns.
And now we've essentially had halloumi added to this list. What would be the impact for the industry if this was to go ahead and you could no longer use these names?
Well, we've got some estimates that the EU's demand to restrict cheese and dairy product names could put at risk local products an aggregate sales value of in excess of $650 million, and the potential direct impact on dairy manufacturers from the strict enforcement of GIs could range, around $70 to $90 million a year in the early stages of the FTA if it was put in place.
Do we know how much of these cheeses are made in Australia?
Cheese manufacturers have a range of capabilities. So on any given day, they could be making a range of products, and it may be that various quantities are made for a particular period of time. And we don't have the data that fully captures those volumes, but we know that it's a significant issue for both large manufacturers and the local, you know, smaller cheese makers. It's worrying enough as it is, but you know, where is it going to stop? And I've opened up the possibility of adding to that list once the agreement is finalised, and it's going a little bit too far in some ways.
That's Terry Richardson. He is chair of the Australian Dairy Industry Council, who's speaking there with Peter Somerville. Now, as you've heard, some concern about what could happen if halloumi is no longer allowed to be used by Australian dairy farmers. Quite a few of your suggestions coming through as alternative names if we do eventually need them, and some very clever ones coming through as well already. Kate at Glenelg says, if we can't say halloumi, how about halloo-you? Very good. Angela says, maybe just spell halloumi backwards, call it emula as another option. And Sean in Mount Gambier has been in touch too, saying they could just call it, I can't believe it's not halloumi. Works for all the European stuff that we make better than them. There you go. If you would like to send us a text, 0467 922 891 is the text number. 0467 922 891. Nikolai Bahlhartz with you. It's 26 to 1, I should say. Now, as I mentioned, there's been a fair bit of excitement in the Angora sector lately. Record high prices for mohair in overseas markets has Australian producers excited ahead of local sales at the end of this month. The average price for Angora goat fibre at a recent sale in South Africa was almost $40 a kilo. Our reporter Hugh Hogan met some producers at the Sydney Royal Easter Show, which is underway at the moment, including Mandy Statham from West Wyalong, who won the champion fleece competition.
This year we've only had fleeces today, and we managed to get grand champion fleece and reserve champion fleece.
Is this the first time you've won that?
It's the first time I've pulled off the double, but I have won champion fleece here before. The micron of my sort of kid fleeces is anywhere from about 17 to 19 micron, which in comparison to fine wool sheep is probably a bit broader. Like, your fine wool sheep is a much less than that. But overall, the micron standard for my flock is about 26 micron, which is really good for Angoras.
And so it changes as they get older?
Yeah, it does. The best fleece is when they're younger, and as they get older, it does go a bit broader.
How long have you been involved with Angora goats?
I've actually been in Angora goats since about 1988. I started I'm an agriculture teacher, and one of my students kept pestering me about these goats, and because I was a sheep and cattle, you know, horse person. Anyway, cut a long story short, I've ended up with goats, and I've been in breeding Angoras ever since. I like their temperament, they're fairly intelligent, and I love their fibre.
What does the mohair fleece go into?
Mohair fleece has a lot of uses. The very fine mohair fleece that we tend to grow ends up in really fine wool suiting, but you do have mohair carpets, and it goes into the knitting as well, so it has a great variety of uses. The thing about Angoras is you shear them every 6 months, so you're getting an income every 6 months, and at the moment the meat price for the Angoras as well as the mohair is astronomical, so it's been very good.
And you mentioned before you've been involved with mohair goats for around 30 years. How is the popularity of them changing? Is it increasing, decreasing? What's happening there?
Over the years, it's gone up and down. It's probably a bit down at the moment, but it varies, you know. So it just, yeah, the price, which is it's a bit ironic at the moment because the price of mohair has gone skyrocketed, and so is the meat price. So it'd be nice to encourage younger people to come into the industry, and I've tried to do that from being an agricultural teacher, and a few of my students have gone on and own goats and things like that, so it's been good.
What's driving that higher fleece price?
Probably comes down to simple supply and demand. You know, the numbers of the goats have dropped, and people want the really luxurious fibre for different things, and that's what's driven the price up.
Oh, g'day, yeah, Nick Gorrie. I'm the president of Mohair Australia. there is a bit of demand. What's happened with COVID is it sort of turned the world upside down, but we've seen there's a shortage in South Africa because of they've had a bad drought, and we've also come out of a drought. So there's good demand and the European mills are looking for it, and we've had some world records come in the last two South African sales.
How high were those records?
The top prices were $75 Australian per kilo for the best kid mohair, and the average was up $35 to $40 a kilo.
Wow, it's a bit more than sheep wool.
Yeah, it's a bit harder to produce. Like, it is, you know, we all have a bit of a joke about it, but it is, you know, you're looking at sort of 2 to 3 kilos of mohair per shearing, and the really good stuff is, it is hard to produce. You've really got to work at it.
And where does most of the world's mohair come from?
The major producer is still South Africa in the Eastern Cape. And then, you know, we're probably in the top three countries.
Yeah. Wow. So us and them both having a big drought really puts a dent in the market.
Yeah, it has. Yeah. A lot of the production areas, like the other big production area traditionally has been Texas, but they've also had, you know, a lot of other things going on in their market. So, you know, the droughts have had a big impact. It's people have reduced their herds and they're just sort of coming out of it and rebounding.
And how has COVID impacted the market for mohair?
Oh, well, the reports we're hearing is that the European mills do want to spin, and they've been, you know, asking and creating the demand. And I think one of the trends we're seeing is people have been at home and they've been doing more home knitting. And so that has been a trend that, you know, traditionally mohair has been made into jumpers and things like that, and home knitting is part of it.
That is Nick Gorrie. He's the president of Mohair Australia, and he was speaking with Hugh Hogan at the Sydney Royal Easter Show. Let's stick with the fibres that make up a lot of the clothing that we wear. Did you know that most of Australia's wool is sent overseas to be cleaned? That's, of course, one step of turning shorn wool into garments. The Australian wool processing industry was once booming, but now there are only a handful of places for producers to have their greasy wool scoured and then spun into yarn. It's one of the reasons why Marilyn Lanyon and her husband Ian decided to take over a woolen quilt business in Bort in Victoria, where they source local wool and have it cleaned nearby. They recently moved their on-farm business to the main street in Bort, with hopes that it could help revitalise the country town and help boost the industry.
It is local wool. It's all processed in Geelong.
How did you go getting the wool cleaned in Victoria? Because there aren't many places to do that.
Yes, that's so right, Eden. The thing is, there is that one in Geelong, but it's the only one in Australia left that is quite big, you know, like can handle with big orders of cleaning. And there are little boutique-y ones around, but it's not, it doesn't suffice for what we're doing.
Because I've spoken to a number of producers that do wish to get their wool cleaned here in Australia but have had challenges. How did you go taking over a business with, I guess, a lot of these products being imported or wool sent overseas? Was this a challenge for you?
They've always had it cleaned, combed and carded in Geelong. Mm. So it's already set up and we were confident, and we've followed what Shirley designed and kept the name going, and we were quite confident that we were doing it the right way. What we do is use Dorset wool, and it's very coarse. It's a 24, 26 micron. Australian carpets are made from the English breed, and I think that that's important that we have a really good wool that we use, even though it's not highly regarded in the wool industry because it's really coarse, and but it stays, it keeps its fluff on, you know, like it's really nice and lofty. The bales come back, they're quite big, and they're a slither, and it's a one long a slither of wool. And what happens is then we lay out the fabric onto the table, and then we put the wool in between. We do one layer from top to toe and the other layer across the bed, so it has two layers of wool. It's a little bit unique, I guess. Normally a factory is a factory, but we're not. We have people come to the farm and visit and that sort of thing as well, and they see it being made. And so now, because what has happened and through talking about it, we decided to relocate everything That's including the sewers and the tables and the layout table, the cutting table, and the back half of the shop is where people view, and then the front of the shop is the retail side where people can come in and ask all the questions and enjoy looking and seeing. And
We're in Bort, the main street of Bort here in northern Victoria. Now, along this street, there aren't a lot of shop fronts. Why is it important, do you think, to have a shop here for the community?
Oh, it's very important. That was one of the main reasons as well that we came into the town, because, you know, there's only 750 people. We're very passionate about Bort and love here and want to have people coming in. Maybe this may be a bit of a draw card. I have noticed, and everyone is saying, there's a lot of people travelling through Bort's main street now with their caravans and whatever. It certainly has grown considerably.
That's Bort's Marilyn Lanyon speaking there with Eden Henninen. Quite a few of your text suggestions on what we should call halloumi if we're not allowed to call it halloumi. The EU pushing for that. Fredo says, why don't you call it Oz Squeaker as an alternative? Lynn at Glenelg says a lahoumi, as in halloumi. And one from Dave too, which I quite like. How about Ozloomy cheese? If you would like to send us a text, 0467 922 891 is the text number.
This is ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
My name's Nikolai Bailharts. It's 14 to 1. And one thing you'll sometimes hear farmers talk about is the idea that they consider themselves price takers and not price makers, that they basically have to accept what someone else is willing to pay them for their produce. But there are some who've tried to change that with their own branded products. Ballantapa Farms' Paul McGoran has been speaking to other farmers about his family's experience with creating their own branded premium lamb product. He spoke with Lucas Forbes about some of the benefits and the pitfalls of moving beyond selling direct to meat processors.
I guess the reason why initially was reduce the reliance on the selling to the processors market. So getting out of the commodity industry and trying to get into a product where we could be the price setter instead of price taker. That was one of the reasons. And then really identifying that there was a gap in the market there that people were looking for to know where the product come from. Consumers wanted to see where it comes from. And we could see at that time there wasn't very many brands in the marketplace there. So a bit of an opportunity.
And now I know you used to supply to a lot of restaurants and a lot of butchers, but I think now you only supply to a couple of butchers. Where are you at with your branded product, and what's caused it to get there?
Yeah, I guess we've gone through a bit of consolidation with our brand. COVID certainly didn't help the cause there. Like when the restaurants were all shut up there for a while, we were supplying a lot of restaurants there, so that hurt us. Butchers were going well through that time, so our butcher sales were going quite well and stayed solid right through COVID. And I guess it's for us just working out really where we want to be positioned ourselves. So we're still doing a bit of exporting there as well. But it's just sort of just working through it at the moment.
How does the sheep go from your paddock to a branded product in a shop?
Yeah, well, it all starts out like so how we're selecting out which ones are going to go to there, because all different shops have different requirements, what they want to have, so different size or different fat score on it there. So we'll select out the right livestock to go through the processor. So then it is building a relationship with that processor to say, all right, this is how... these are the lambs I've got. This is where I want them to go. This is how I want them presented when they go. So we have a strip brand on there with our name on it on each carcass. Back when we were doing into the restaurant trade, it was really identifying how they'll cut up each lamb and how we wanted the stickers looking put on each pack and then in each carton. So it is sort of hands-on with that. But then once you form the relationship with the right team around you there, it can be a bit more straightforward.
One thing I thought was interesting was towards the end of your talk, you talked about the reasons why someone might want to go into branding their product, and I suppose the reasons why people shouldn't. Would you mind just like sort of running through what you talked about?
Yeah, no worries. Well, I definitely like some of the reasons why people should get into branding is like why we did, because you don't want to be a price taker. You want to try to be a price setter, and you want to have that your product out there, get on that industry trend. I guess some of the, there's more reasons probably why you wouldn't get in there is looking at some of the financial risks when you're dealing with a lot of different butcher shops and that sort of thing. It can be, yeah, certainly more risky than dealing with the one bigger processor who's going to be more reliant for their payments. And then also the time involvement in there as well. So I think that's some of the issues that people just got to weigh up. So that determines really why do they want to do it. And it is, as I said in the presentation, it is great for the ego to when you see your product sitting in a butcher shop or on a menu.
You said that you wanted to get into this because you wanted to reduce your reliance on a single major processor. How do you feel you are with that at the moment?
I think it wasn't just reliance on one processor. Like, we have a fantastic relationship with Thomas Foods, and that's who we supply the bulk of our lambs to as unbranded commodity lambs, so from our business. But it's more about just not just reliance on the process, but reliance on the market, the commodity market, so the fluctuations that you see in the market there. That's where we wanted to be able to become price takers and put a little bit more consistency and solidarity into the pricing there.
That is Ballantappa Farms' Paul McGorman speaking there with Lucas Forbes. It's 9-1. Well, birds can be a major headache for farmers. No one knows that better than Tasmanian hazelnut grower Greg Taylor. For years, he's watched the cockies pinch hazelnuts from his orchard, but this season he's got a new line of defence. Lachlan Bennett has the story.
Yeah, we have a few feathered friends in the district. Yeah, the cockatoos have been one of the challenges which has emerged for us over recent years. They're in this general area, in this general Don River Valley area, I'd describe it as, and between about January and May, they seem to be here a lot of the time. It's not just us they come to see, it's the general district, but they do have a taste for hazelnuts, and that has posed some problems for us.
I imagine I can just hear how many there are flying out there. What does that mean for you in trying to get your crop off?
Well, we have to be have to come up with a strategy to try and deal with it, because if we look at the trajectory of what's been happening over the last couple of years, every year it's been a bit more cockatoos around. If we looked at that trajectory, then we say that in the near future we'd be not having much nuts at all if we let them have access to our crops. So there had to be something done to manage that. And that's we looked around long and hard at the various options available to us, and we have now come up with a strategy which at the moment does appear to be working.
And that's a strategy that involves some relatively new technology. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, it is new technology, certainly to us, and I think fairly new to even Australia. It's using lasers, basically, as a bird deterrent. The theory is that the birds are scared of the laser light, and when the light moves across an area they're in, the birds will fly away. So it acts as a deterrent for the birds. The technology, I think, originally came from around airstrips, where the mix of especially jet engines and birds is really deadly. So there's been quite a long history of deterring birds in that situation. And the application to agriculture is something that, you know, is just being worked through now. I suppose we're still learning how that all works.
You wanted to experiment with something. Something had to be done to stop these birds from taking advantage of all your hard work.
Yeah, well, that's it. And we looked at the various options. You know, the controlling birds in agriculature is a timeless thing. Really, it's been going on ever since people have been farming. But how to do it in a way which is suitable to our environment. And for us, it's really important not to be harmful to the birds. We don't want to harm them if we can avoid that at all. But something which does allow us to farm. We need to be able to farm as well to grow our crops. So we looked at the various options, which I guess the most common one would be netting. That works out to be a really expensive option. It can work for high-value crops like cherries or blueberries or grapes, perhaps. But for our crops of hazelnuts, which are over a fairly large area, netting was just not a viable, cost-effective option for us. High maintenance and lots of labour input into it as well. There's various other bird deterrent options around, like gas guns, which go off periodically and frighten the birds away. Our experience with those was that they work for a little while, but the birds soon learn that they're not a real threat, and so the guns don't deter birds in the long term. That's been our experience with that.
Do you have similar concerns about the lasers, that after a while the birds might get used to them?
Yeah, exactly that. That's why I'm still consciously saying we're in a trial period and we're still working through the results. The key thing is that to what extent do the birds habituate to the lasers? The advice that we've heard from other people is that they don't, but I guess in every situation is going to be different, and certainly ours is different, and we need to look at our situation and say, well, you know, it's been going okay here for a few weeks now, but what will it be like in another few weeks? Will the birds actually suss it out and work it out? I think the cockatoos are very intelligent animals. Perhaps they're underestimated by people a lot of the time, but they're very intelligent. They're extremely good communicators. They've got a great memory. They know where the crops are. They know where to be when. So they are a real foe. They can learn things and they can figure things out. And we're waiting to see how well that goes in the longer term before we make any conclusions.
That is Greg Taylor from Mount Rowland Hazelnuts speaking there with Lachlan Bennett about that new defence against cockatoos. Well, let's move to birds of a different kind now. Kelpram Station in the Riverlands got a flock of new residents. The Australian Landscape Trust says a large swan breeding event has occurred this watering year, the largest for the station's floodplains in recent times. Manager and senior ecologist Peter Kale says the whole Riverland region has experienced a large breeding event this year, partly due to the delivery of environmental water. He says maintaining the flora of the wetlands is important for keeping up biodiversity.
Swans are a species that really breed in large colonial systems, and we have records going back to the 1980s of swan breeding on both Lake Walpole and Lake Merrity. And it's very periodic and generally associated with flood events. But with recent waterings that we've been doing since the new regulators went in 2014 and the wetting and drying systems that we've set up there, this particular year we've had a massive event, which is, as far as I know, the largest event on the two lakes. We've had over 200 clutches of swans being produced on the two lakes, and up to about 1,200 cygnets have been generated from those clutches. And the lakes have supported them for a period of time, but our other environmental watering sites have enabled us to keep those swans on the floodplain throughout their full growth period, which is actually quite long. It's nearly 6 months. And now most of those birds are at a stage where they're effectively adults and can fly off and spread out into other areas where they can breed somewhere else.
And what does that say about the health of the system and where things are at now?
Yeah, there's always complications with these things because the river system as a whole changes from year to year with climatic conditions, etc. But there's been a big swan event throughout the whole of the Riverland of South Australia this year, and I think that is a clear indication that all of the different watering events that have been happening in the last 5 or 6 years through that region have really shifted that system into a site where the critical mass is there for those breeding events to occur.
So looking ahead, Peter, what's the plan and what are you hoping to see on your site?
Yeah, well, we're obviously hoping to maintain those really good water bird numbers. It's one of the key components of our floodplain. It's one of the reasons why it was identified as a Ramsar International Wetland. And so we're looking to generate more opportunities for the different types of water birds to utilise the site throughout the season. And that's really about timing of the different watering events throughout each year. So the other component is we've got a few sites where we are literally starting from scratch and they're in a pretty bad state, and we're really looking to see some significant changes in their overall condition.
That is the Australian Landscape Trust's Peter Kale speaking there with Anita Ward. And that's pretty much it for me this afternoon. Don't forget, though, you can always find out a whole lot more about what's going on when it comes to rural and regional stories up online at abc.net.au/rural, including some interesting details about retirees now stepping in to help pick apples in some parts of the country to try and to take on that work when job seekers fail to turn up for work. So all those details and more up on the web at abc.net.au/rural.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.